Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
I want to say it very clearly. It is because I define myself as an ardent Zionist that thinks that the best for the Jews in Israel is that we abandon the territories and we dismantle settlements and we try to reach a reasonable settlement with our Palestinian partners.
Now, it is correct to say that if you frame everything in terms of what Israel wanted, it made huge concessions. However, if you frame things in terms of what Israel was legally entitled to under international law, then Israel made precisely and exactly zero concessions.
Norman Finkelstein, one of the foremost critics of Israeli policy, debates Shlomo Ben-Ami, a former Israeli foreign minister. What may be more interesting than their disagreements is how much the former Israeli foreign minister agrees with his critic. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Haiti, public unrest is growing as the lead of presidential frontrunner René Préval continues to decline. After initial returns gave him over 60% of the vote, Préval's share has fallen below the 50% needed to avoid a runoff vote. Two voting officials have charged Haiti's Electoral Council with manipulation. On Monday, thousands of Préval's supporters took to the streets around the capital of Port-au-Prince. Witnesses said United Nations troops fired into a crowd of unarmed protesters when they refused to let their convoy pass. At least two people were reported killed and another four injured. The Bush administration is on the defensive over Vice President Dick Cheney's shooting of his hunting companion, Republican fundraiser Harry Whittington, at a Texas ranch Saturday. Whittington is reported to be in stable condition. It took the White House at least 19 hours to inform the public, and only after a local Texas newspaper broke the story of the accidental shooting. Cheney's also coming under criticism for violating Texas game law. On Monday, state officials said Cheney had not purchased a stamp required for bird hunting. In other news, the New York Times is reporting the U.S. and Israel are considering a campaign to destabilize the Palestinian Authority so that Palestinians will grow frustrated and force a Hamas-led government to call new elections. According to anonymous U.S. and Israeli officials, one of the main options under consideration is starving the Palestinian Authority of money and aid. In Iran, the government says it's resumed small-scale enrichment of uranium, defying an international effort to limit its nuclear activity. The news comes amid fresh speculation over a possible U.S. attack on Iran. Over the weekend, the Sunday Telegraph reported the Pentagon has drawn up an attack plan as a last resort to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. An anonymous senior Pentagon official said, quote, "This is more than just the standard military contingency assessment. This has taken on much greater urgency in recent months." Back in the United States, the Associated Press is reporting three former associates of indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff says he frequently told them he had strong ties to the White House through senior presidential adviser Karl Rove. On Monday, the White House said Rove considers Abramoff to be a, quote, casual acquaintance. New questions concerning Abramoff's ties to the White House have arisen with the publication of an email in which Abramoff said he had met with President Bush in almost a dozen settings. On Saturday, Time magazine published a photograph of Abramoff attending a White House gathering hosted by President Bush in May 2001. The White House had previously said there was no record of Abramoff attending the event. They've also refused to release several other photos reportedly showing Abramoff with the president. The New York Times is reporting what it calls, quote, one of the biggest giveaways of oil and gas in American history. Under a congressional measure enacted 10 years ago to encourage drilling, energy companies will be allowed to extract about $65 billion worth of oil and natural gas from federal land over the next 5 years without paying taxpayers any royalties. According to the Times, the government will give up over $7 billion in lost royalties over the next 5 years. And finally, a new report from the Government Accountability Office says the Bush administration has spent over $1.6 billion on advertising and public relations contracts in the last 2 years. Of this amount, the Pentagon has been the biggest spender, paying $1.1 billion for recruitment campaigns and other public relations efforts. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. What happens when a former former Israeli foreign minister, debates a scholar known as one of the world's foremost critics of Israeli policy. The answer is not what you may expect. Last week, Shlomo Ben-Ami and Norman Finkelstein joined us in our Firehouse studio for a wide-ranging exchange that lasted close to 2 hours. Today, we bring you an edited version of what they had to say. Shlomo Ben-Ami is both an insider and a scholar. As foreign minister under Ehud Barak, he was a key participant in years of Israel-Palestinian peace talks, including the Camp David and Taba talks in 2000 and 2001. An Oxford-trained historian, his new book is Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, the Israeli-Arab Tragedy. President Bill Clinton says, quote, Shlomo Ben-Ami worked tirelessly and courageously for peace. His account of what he did and failed to do and where we go from here should be read by everyone who wants a just and lasting resolution. We're also joined by Norman Finkelstein. He's a professor of political science at DePaul University in Chicago. His latest book is Beyond Chutzpah, on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. Avi Schleim, Israeli scholar at Oxford University, calls Beyond Chutzpah brilliantly illuminating on display are all the sterling qualities for which Finkelstein has become famous. We tried to cover as much ground as we could, from the origins of the conflict to the Oslo peace process to the present. I began by asking the foreign minister of Israel, Shlomo Ben-Ami, about the founding of Israel in 1948.
In 1948, what was born was a state, but also a regional superpower in many ways. We have prevailed over the invading Arab armies and the local population, which was practically evicted from Palestine, from the state of Israel, from what became the state of Israel, and this is how the refugee problem was born. Interestingly, the Arabs in 1948 lost a war that was, as far as they were concerned, lost already in 1936, 1939, because they have fought against the British Mandate and the Israeli or the Jewish Yishuv, the Jewish pre-state, and they were defeated then. So they came to the hour of trial in 1948 already as a defeated nation. That is, the war of 1948 was won already in 1936, and they had no chance to win the war in 1948. They were already a defeated nation when they faced the Israeli superpower that was emerging in that year.
You have some very strong quotes in your book of your own and quoting others, like Bert Katznelson, who is the main ideologue of the labor movement, acknowledging that in the wake of the 1929 Arab riots, the Zionist enterprise is an enterprise of conquest. You also say the reality on the ground was that of an Arab community in a state of terror, facing a ruthless Israeli army whose path to victory was paved not only by its exploits against the regular Arab armies, but also by the intimidation and at times atrocities and massacres it perpetuated against the, or it perpetrated against the civilian Arab community. A panic-stricken Arab community was uprooted under the impact of massacres that would be carved into the Arabs' monument of grief and hatred. Explain that further.
Well, you see, there is a whole range of new historians that have gone into the sources of the origins of the State of Israel. Among them, you mentioned Avi Schleim, but there are many, many others that have exposed this, the evidence of what really went on the ground. And I must, from the very beginning, say that the main difference between what they say and my vision of things is not the facts. The facts, they are absolutely correct in mentioning the facts and putting the record straight. My view is that but for Jesus Christ, everybody was born in sin, including nations. And the moral perspective of it is there, but at the same time, it does not undermine, in my view, in my very modest view, the justification for the creation of a Jewish state, however tough the conditions and however immoral the consequences were for the Palestinians.
I did want you to step back, Shlomo Ben-Ami, and give us an overview of the whole peace process, of which you were a part, a critical player in this, the Oslo Peace Accords in 1993. Can you talk about what they entailed, why they failed?
Well, the Oslo peace process was an agreement. It started as an agreement between two unequal partners. Arafat conceived Oslo as a way, not necessarily to reach a settlement, but more importantly to him at that particular moment, in order to come back to the territories and control the politics of the Palestinian family. Don't forget that the Intifada, to which Oslo brought an end, started independently of the PLO leadership, and he saw how he was losing control of the destiny of the Palestinians. His only way to get back to the territories was through an agreement with Israel. So in Oslo, he made enormous concessions. In fact, when he was negotiating in Oslo with us, an official Palestinian delegation was negotiating with an official Israeli delegation in Washington. And the official Palestinian delegation was asking the right things from the viewpoint of the Palestinians: self-determination, right of return, end of occupation, all the necessary arguments. Whereas Arafat in Oslo reached an agreement that didn't even mention the right of self-determination for the Palestinians, doesn't even mention the need of the Israelis to put an end to settlements. If the Israelis, after Oslo, continued expansion of settlements, they were violating the spirit of Oslo, not the letter of Oslo. There's nothing in the Oslo agreement that says that Israelis cannot build settlements. So this was the cheap agreement that Arafat sold, precisely because he wanted to come back to the territories and control the politics of Palestine. Now, the thing is that a major problem with Oslo, on top of it, was that it solved very minor issues, such as Gaza, and that even people on the far Israeli right were ready to give away Gaza. But it left open the future. The future was unknown. The two sides, the two parties, started to embark on a process when they had diametrically opposed views as to the final objective. There was nothing as to what will happen about Jerusalem. It was only said that we will negotiate Jerusalem. What about refugees? Nothing clear was said, just that we will negotiate the refugees. So the fact that the future was left so wide open was a standing invitation for the parties to dictate, to try and dictate the nature of the final agreement through unilateral acts. The Israelis by expanding settlements, and the Palestinians by responding with terrorism. So this symmetry that was created in Oslo persists to this very day. So Oslo could not usher in a final agreement because of the different expectations that the parties had. It was an exercise in make-believe. The Palestinians didn't even mention self-determination, so a leader like Rabin could have thought that, okay, we will have an agreement that will create something which is a state minus. This was Rabin's expression. He never thought this will end in a full-fledged Palestinian state. There was a lot of of ambiguity, constructive ambiguity, might Kissinger say, but I think it was destructive ambiguity. It helped, this destructive ambiguity helped in clinching the Oslo Agreement, but it was a minefield for those who went to Camp David and later on to Taba to try and solve all the pending issues.
Professor Norman Finkelstein.
Well, I'm going to try to focus on the key points. There are issues about the refugees in Jerusalem, which for now I can't get into, but I would be happy to return to them later when we discuss what was the impasse at the impasse at Camp David and Taba. But I want to set the context, and I don't think I agree in part with the context that Dr. Ben-Ami set out, but not fully. The main context, in my opinion, is as follows. Since the mid-1970s, there's been an international consensus for resolving the Israel-Palestine conflict. Most of your listeners will be familiar with it. It's called the Two-State Settlement. And the Two-State Settlement is pretty straightforward, uncomplicated. Israel has to fully withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem in accordance with the fundamental principle of international law, cited three times by Mr. Ben-Ami in his book, that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. The West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem having been acquired by war, it's inadmissible for Israel to keep them. They have to be returned. On the Palestinian side, and also the side of the neighboring Arab states, they have to recognize Israel's right to live in peace and security with its neighbors. That was the quid pro quo. Recognition of Israel, Palestinian right to self-determination in the West Bank and Gaza with its capital in Jerusalem. That's the international consensus. It's not complicated. It's also not controversial. You see it voted on every year in the United Nations. The vote's typically something like 160 nations on one side, the United States, Israel, and Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands on the other side. That's it. Now, the Israeli government was fully aware that this was the international consensus, but they were opposed, A, to a full withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem, of course, and two, they were opposed to creating a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. Come 1981, as pressure builds on Israel to reach a diplomatic settlement in the Israel-Palestine conflict, they decide to invade Lebanon in order to crush the PLO because the PLO was on record supporting a two-state settlement. As Dr. Ben-Ami's colleague, Avner Yaniv, put it in a very excellent book, Dilemmas of Security, he said the main problem for Israel was, and now I'm quoting him, the PLO's peace offensive. They wanted a two-state settlement. Israel did not, and so Israel decides to crush the PLO in Lebanon. It successfully did so. The PLO goes into exile. Come 1987, Palestinians in the occupied territories despair of any possibility of international intervention, and they enter into a revolt, the Palestinian Intifada, basically nonviolent civilian revolt by the Palestinians. And the revolt proves to be remarkably successful for maybe the first couple of years. Come 1990, Iraq invades Kuwait. The PLO supports, ambiguously, but I think we fairly can say, and I agree with Dr. Ben-Ami on this, they lend support to Iraq. The war ends, Iraq defeated, and all the Gulf states cut off all of their money to the PLO. The PLO is going down the tubes. Along comes Israel with a clever idea. Mr. Rabin says, let's throw Arafat a life preserver, but on condition. And Dr. Ben-Ami puts it excellently, that the PLO will be Israel's subcontractor and collaborator in the occupied territories, and now I'm quoting Dr. Ben-Ami, in order to suppress the genuinely democratic tendencies of the Palestinians. Now, it's true, exactly as Dr. Ben-Ami said, that Israel had two options after the Iraq War. It could have negotiated with the real representatives of the Palestinians who wanted that full two-state settlement in accordance with the international consensus, or it can negotiate with Arafat in the hope that he's so desperate he's going to serve as their collaborator and subcontractor in order to deny the Palestinians what they're entitled to under international law. The Israelis chose Arafat, not only because Arafat himself was desperate. They chose him because they thought he would deny them what they were entitled to. He would suppress all resistance to the occupation.
Professor Norman Finkelstein, author of Beyond Chutzpah, more from his debate with former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami after the break. Latif Al-Idrisi here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue today with the debate between Professor Norman Finkelstein and former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami, since the outbreak of the latest Palestinian Intifada in the fall of 2000, the subject of what happened during the final round of peace talks at Camp David in July 2000 and at Taba in January 2001 has been the subject of much debate. The Israeli government and its supporters have blamed the Palestinians for rejecting what they say was a generous offer that would have given them a viable state. The Palestinians say Israel never made an offer that even approaches meeting their minimal rights. Each side has used the other's alleged position to assign blame for the violence that's plunged the conflict into deeper chaos. We begin this part of the debate with Professor Norman Finkelstein talking about the peace talks at Camp David in July 2000.
My concern is, let's look at the diplomatic record, the factual record. What were the offers being made on each side at the Camp David and the Taba talks? And the standard interpretation, which is, you can call it the Dennis Ross interpretation, which I think, unfortunately, Dr. Ben-Ami echoes, is that Israel made huge concessions at Camp David and Taba. Palestinians refused to make any concessions because of what Dr. Ben-Ami repeatedly calls Arafat's unyielding positions, and that Arafat missed a huge opportunity. Now, it is correct to say that if you frame everything in terms of what Israel wanted, it made huge concessions. However, if you frame things in terms of what Israel was legally entitled to under international law, then Israel made precisely and exactly zero concessions. All the concessions were made by the Palestinians. Briefly, because we don't have time, there were four key issues at Camp David and at Taba. Number one, settlements. Number two, borders. Number three, Jerusalem. Number four, refugees. Let's start with settlements. Under international law, there is no dispute, no controversy. Under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it's illegal for any occupying country to transfer its population to occupied territories. All of the settlements are illegal under international law. No dispute. The World Court in July 2004 ruled that all the settlements are illegal. The Palestinians were willing to concede 50% of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. That was a monumental concession, going well beyond anything that was demanded of them under international law. Borders. The principle is clear. I don't want to get into it now because I was very glad to see that Dr. Ben-Ami quoted it three times in his book. It's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. Under international law, Israel had to withdraw from all of the West Bank and all of Gaza. As the World Court put it in July 2004, those are, quote, occupied Palestinian territories. Now, however you want to argue over percentages, there is no question, and I know Dr. Ben-Ami won't dispute it, the Palestinians were willing to make concessions on the borders. What percentage? There's differences. But there's no question they were willing to make concessions. Jerusalem's an interesting case, because if you read Dr. Ben-Ami or the standard mainstream accounts in the United States, everyone talks about the huge concessions that Barak was willing to make on Jerusalem. But under international law, Israel has not one atom of sovereignty over any of Jerusalem. Read the World Court decision. The World Court decision said Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. Now, the Palestinians were willing, the exact lines I'm not going to get into now. They are complicated. But I'm sure Dr. Ben-Ami will not dispute. They were willing to divide Jerusalem roughly in half, the Jewish side to Israel, the Arab side to the Palestinians. And number four, refugees. On the question of refugees, it's not a dispute under international law. Remarkably, even fairly conservative human rights organizations like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, in 2000 during the Camp David talks, they issued statements on the question of the right of return. And they stated categorically, under international law, every Palestinian, roughly 5 to 6 million, has the right to return, not to some little parcels, 1% of Israel, which Israel would swap, return to their homes or the environs of their homes in Israel. That's the law. Now, Dr. Ben-Ami will surely agree that the Palestinians were not demanding and never demanded the full return of 6 million refugees. He gives a figure of 400,000 to 800,000. In fact, I'm not going to get into the numbers because it's very hard to pin it down. Other authors have given figures of the tens of thousands to 200,000 refugees returning. That's well short of 6 million. On every single issue, all the concessions came from the Palestinians. The problem is everyone, including Dr. Ben-Ami in his book, he begins with what Israel wants and how much of it wants it's willing to give up. But that's not the relevant framework. The only relevant framework is, under international law, what you're entitled to. And when you use that framework, it's a very, very different picture.
If you can bear to make this response brief, yes. Dr. Shlomo Ben-Ami.
Okay, in the last third part of the book, as Dr. Finkelstein says, there is the diplomat, and this same diplomat still behaves in a way as a historian when he says in this book that Camp David was not the missed opportunity for the Palestinians, and if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well. This is something I put in the book. But Taba is the problem. The Clinton parameters are the problem. Because the Clinton parameters, in my view...
Maybe you can explain them what that is. I don't think most people will know the Clinton parameters.
So well, the Clinton parameters say the following. They say that on the territorial issue, the Palestinians will get 100% of Gaza, 97% of the West Bank, plus a safe passage from Gaza to the West Bank to make the state viable. There will be a land swap. The 97%, which I mentioned, takes into account the land swap. or they will get 3% on this side within the state of Israel. So we will have the blocks of settlements, and they will be able to settle refugees on this side of the border. About Jerusalem, it says what is Jewish is Israeli, and what is Palestinian is what is Arab is Palestinian. It includes full-fledged sovereignty for the Palestinians on Temple Mount, on the Haram al-Sharif. No Jewish sovereignty on the Haram al-Sharif, which was at the time and continues to be a major problem for Israelis and Jews, that these things mean to them a lot. And then with the question of refugees, it says that the refugees will return to historic Palestine, to historical Palestine, and that Israel will maintain its sovereign right of admission. That is, it will have to absorb a number of refugees, but with restrictions that need to be negotiated between the parties. But the bulk of the refugees will be allowed to return to the state of Palestine. This is the essence of the Clinton parameters. Of Dr. Finkelstein said here about international law, I want to make it clear, it is important, it is vital for a civilized community of nations to have an axis of principles based on international law around which to run the affairs of our chaotic world. It is very important, it is vital, etc. But at the same time, when you go into political issues and you need to settle differences, historical differences, differences that have to do with political rights, security concerns, historical memories, etc., it is almost impossible to do things on the basis of international law, but rather on something that is as close as possible to the requirements of international law. The very fact that, as Dr. Finkelstein rightly says, the Palestinians were ready to make this or that concession is the reflection of them understanding that there is no viability, there is no possibility really to reach an agreement that says let us apply automatically and rigidly the requirements of international law.
Former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami debating Norman Finkelstein in a Firehouse studio. We moved our discussion then to the last time Israelis and Palestinians met for peace negotiations in the Egyptian resort town of Taba in January 2001. This is Norman Finkelstein.
What actually happened? What actually happened was exactly as what was announced by the White House spokesman on January 3rd, 2001. The official statement was, both the Israelis and the Palestinians have accepted the Clinton parameters with some reservations. Both sides entered reservations on the Clinton parameters. Yeah, Dr. Ben-Ami leaves out in the book both sides. He only mentions the reservations by the Palestinians. Number two, I was surprised to notice One of the books Dr. Ben-Ami recommends is the book by Clayton Swisher called The Truth at Camp David. I looked in the book on page 402 of Clayton Swisher's book when he's discussing the issue of entering reservations to Clinton's parameters. He quotes none other than Shlomo Ben-Ami. You acknowledged, you call them relatively minor, but you acknowledged that Barak entered, you called it several pages of reservations. In fact, Barak sent a 10-page letter of reservations to the Clinton parameters. It was exactly symmetrical. Both the Israelis and the Palestinians agreed to the Clinton parameters with some reservations. Yeah. Wait, one last point. One last point. Dr. Ben-Ami left out another crucial point in his account. He doesn't tell us why Taba ended. It ended officially when Barak withdrew his negotiators. It wasn't the Palestinians who walked out of Taba. It ended with the Israelis walking out of Taba, a matter of the historical record, not even controversial.
Dr. Benamou.
Okay, well, you see, as somebody who was part of those who prepared the Israeli document that was submitted to President Clinton, I can say that the bulk of the document was an expression of our the comparison that we made between our initial positions and the and what was reflected in the Clinton parameters. It was not a series of reservations. It was basically a mention of the difference, the way that we have gone. This was an attempt to impress the president more than an attempt to say that these are reservations, sine qua nons. There were no real reservations in our document, whereas in the Palestinian document there were plenty of them, with the refugees, with the Haram al-Sharif, with what have you. I mean, it was full of reservations from beginning to end. Ours was not a document about reservations. It was a statement, basically, that said, these were our positions, this is where we stand today. We have gone a very long way. We cannot go beyond that. This was essentially what we sent. Now, with regard to Taba, you see, we were a government committing suicide, practically, 2 weeks before general elections. The chief of staff, General Mofaz, who is now the Minister of Defense, comes, and I say that in the book, in something that is tantamount to a coup d'etat, comes and say publicly that we are putting at risk the future of the State of Israel by assuming the Clinton parameters, and we accept them. We assume them. And then I go to Cairo, and I meet President Mubarak. And President Mubarak invites Arafat to see me in Cairo. And I say to Arafat, we're going to fine-tune this in a meeting in Taba, if you wish. And then we go to Taba, and we negotiate in Taba. And in Taba, Prime Minister Barak instructs me to conduct secret negotiations with Abu Allah. Within the negotiations, we had a second track, trying to reach an agreement. And he even agrees to all kinds of things that he was not very open to before that. Now, this was the end. We saw that we are not reaching an agreement. And we need to go back, even if for the electoral campaign. I mean, we were a week before the elections. I mean, we were practically non-existent. We were, our legitimacy as a government to negotiate such central issues as Jerusalem, as Temple Mount, the temple, etc., was being questioned not only by the right that was making political capital out of it, but by the left, people from our own government. Shlomo Ben-Ami is ready to sell out the country for the sake of a Nobel Prize. This is what Chaim Ramon said, one of the labor ministers. So it was unsustainable. We could not go any longer. So
former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami discussing the breakdown of the peace talks at Taba in January 2001. Israel and the Palestinians have not met for final status peace talks since. This is Democracy Now! Back with the final part of our debate after break. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to our debate between the former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, and Professor Norman Finkelstein, I asked Finkelstein to discuss a section in his new book called The Not-So-New Anti-Semitism.
Well, actually, I think it's useful to connect it with the conversation we've just had. Namely, I think when honest and reasonable people enter into a discussion about this topic, you'll have large areas of agreement, some area of disagreement. And frankly, and I'm not saying it to flatter, I say it because I believe it. I don't flatter by nature. I'm quite certain that if representatives of the Palestinians were to sit down with Shlomo Ben-Ami in a room, weren't subjected to the sorts of political pressures that Dr. Ben-Ami describes from Israel, I think a reasonable settlement could be reached. And I think he's reasonable, in my opinion. We can disagree on some issues, but he's reasonable. The problem is when you get to the United States. In the United States, among those people who call themselves supporters of Israel, we enter the area of unreason. We enter a twilight zone. American Jewish organizations, they're not only not up to speed yet with Steven Spielberg, they're still in the Leon Uris Exodus version of history, the "this land is mine, God gave this land to me." And anybody who dissents from this, you can call it lunatic version of history, is immediately branded an anti-Semite. And whenever Israel comes under international pressure to settle the conflict diplomatically, or when it is subjected to a public relations debacle, such as it was with the Second Intifada, a campaign is launched claiming there's a new anti-Semitism afoot in the world. There's no evidence of a new anti-Semitism. If you go through all the literature, as I have, the evidence is actually in Europe, which is Dr. Ben-Ami's half-home ground, Spain, but throughout Europe. The evidence is, if you look at like the Pew Charitable Trust surveys, anti-Semitism has actually declined since the last time they did the surveys. They did it in 1991 and 2002. They said the evidence is that it's declined. And the same thing in the United States. What's called the new anti-Semitism is anyone who criticizes any official Israeli policies. In fact, my guess is, had people not known who wrote Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, that book would immediately be put on the ADL's list of verboten books, an example of anti-Semitism, because he says things like, the Zionists wanted to transfer the Arabs out. That's anti-Semitism. It has nothing to do with the real world. It's a public relations extravaganza production to deflect attention from the facts, from the realities. And I think this afternoon in our exchange, there were some areas of disagreement for sure, but I think a lot of what Dr. Ben-Ami said would not go down well with most of American Jewry. And that's when they'll soon be charging him with being an anti-Semite.
On the issue of language, terrorism, Arafat called terrorists, Hamas called terrorists. How would you describe the Israeli state when it attacks civilians in the occupied territories? Or how would you describe Ariel Sharon?
Well, let me tell you what is my description of terrorism. Terrorism, in my view, is an indiscriminate attack against civilian population. If I, personally, or my son, God forbid, is being attacked, being in uniform in Palestinian territories by a Hamas squad, I will not define this as terrorism. I will define as terrorism if they go into a kindergarten or a mall, explode themselves, and cause injuries and death among civilian population. This, to me, is now the problem of the response of a state is much more difficult to define, because a state needs to go not against the civilian population. It needs to go against military targets, ticking bombs. This is what states can do and should do. The problem is that when you have a fight not against armies, which is the case of Syria, Egypt, we never spoke about terrorism, state, Israeli state terrorism against the Egyptians. We spoke about wars between two military sides. This is very difficult in the conditions prevailing in places like Gaza or the West Bank, where you have militias, you have arsenals of weapons, etc., and the army attacks them, and there is collateral damage to civilian population. To me, this is very difficult to define as state terrorism. It is attacking military objectives or sort of military objectives, an army which is not a real army but can cause damage, and you need to fight back and defend your population. And it is very, very unfortunate that civilians are hit. But if Israel targets intentionally civilians, this is a different matter. This can be defined as state terrorism. I don't believe that we have done it normally. The practice is that things happened collaterally.
I'd like to get your response, Professor Finkelstein, and also if you could include in that, you have a chapter in Beyond Chutzpah called Israel's Abu Ghraib.
Well, on the issue of terrorism, I agree with Dr. Ben-Ami's definition. It's the indiscriminate targeting of civilians to achieve political ends. That's a capsule definition, but I think for our purposes it suffices. What does the record show? Let's limit ourselves to just the Second Intifada from September 28th to the present. For that period, the record shows approximately 3,000 Palestinians have been killed, approximately 900 Israelis have been killed. On the Palestinian side and the Israeli side, I'm now using the figures of B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. On the Palestinian and the Israeli side, roughly one half to two-thirds of the total number were civilians or bystanders. And if you look at the findings of the human rights reports, B'Tselem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Physicians for Human Rights in Israel, and so forth, they all say that Israel uses reckless, indiscriminate fire against Palestinians. And B'Tselem says when you have so many civilian casualties, you have, 600 Palestinian children who have been killed, which is the total number of Israeli civilians killed, 600 Palestinian children killed. They said when you have so many civilians killed, I don't particularly like the phrase collateral damage. When you have so many civilians killed, B'Tselem says it hardly makes a difference whether you're purposely targeting them or not. The state has responsibility. So you could say Israel, using numbers now, is responsible for three times as much terrorism in the occupied territories as Palestinians against Israel. That's the question of terrorism. Let's turn to an ancillary issue, the issue of torture. Now, the estimates are up to 1994, 1995, that Israel tortured, and I'm using the language of Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, Israel has tortured tens of thousands of Palestinian detainees. Israel was the only country in the world, the only one, which had legalized torture from 1987 to 1999. The record on torture, on house demolitions, and targeted...
1999 is when we came to office.
I wish that were the saving grace, but the fact of the matter is, being faithful to the historical record, the record of labor has been much worse on human rights violations than the record of the Likud. It's a fact that the only Israeli government during the period from 1967 to the present, which temporarily suspended torture, was Begin from 1979 to 1981. On the record of house demolitions, Mr. Rabin used to boast that he demolished many more homes than any Likud government. Even on the record of settlements, as Dr. Ben-Ami well knows, the record of Rabin was worse in terms of settlement expansion than the record of Yitzhak Shamir. And a fact he leaves out in the book, the record of Barak on housing startups in the occupied territories.
Building more houses.
Yeah, was worse than the record of Netanyahu. It's a paradox for, I'm sure, American listeners, but the record on human rights, an abysmal record in general, and in particular, the worst record is the record of labor, not Likud.
Professor Norman Finkelstein, author of Beyond Chutzpah. We move ahead to Shlomo Ben-Ami. In this last part of the debate, I asked the former Israeli foreign minister to discuss Israel's human rights record and the allegations it's tortured tens of thousands of Palestinians.
Tell you the truth, I don't know about the numbers, and we have seen different governments in the British have done it. What the British did in Palestine in the 30s is there is nothing new in what we did that the British didn't do before us. And the Americans now in Iraq and elsewhere, what I find very, very uncomfortable is really is this singling out Israel that lives in a very unique sort of situation in comparison with other countries.
Norman Finkelstein makes the point Israel's Abu Ghraib, so that you're making reference to what America did.
If you would come from another planet and examine the resolutions of the UN, the Security Council, you might reach the conclusion that there is only one sinner in this planet, and this is the State of Israel, and not anybody else.
But I'm quoting your own human rights organizations.
That's okay.
B'Tselem is not the United Nations.
It speaks in favor of Israel that we have our human rights, we have B'Tselem, and we criticize ourselves, and we want to change things.
I agree with that, but then you have to say it doesn't speak too much in Israel's favor. That's the only country in the world that legalized torture. It was also the only country in the world that legalized hostage taking. Your Chief Justice called it, keeping Lebanese as bargaining chips. Israel was the only country in the world that's legalized house demolitions as a form of punishment. Those things have to also be included in the record. I totally agree with you. It's to Israel's credit that it has a B'Tselem, an organization for which I have the highest regard and esteem. I agree with that.
The conditions where Israel has to operate. We do not have Sweden and Denmark as neighbors. And we have neighbors that have taken hostages, have taken hostages that forced us to exchange things that were not very popular. Rabin himself gave away 1,500 Palestinian and Lebanese prisoners in exchange for three Israeli soldiers, and Sharon gave away 400 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for four bodies of Israeli soldiers. So we are living in that kind of place.
But that may tell you that's because they take so many people prisoner that they have a lot to give back.
Right now, as we speak, there are
9,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israel.
Because we live in the condition that we live. This is not Scandinavia.
Dr. Ben-Ami, you know as well as I do, international law does not apply to some countries and not to others, and some continents and not to others. Either it applies to everybody or it applies to nobody. So to use the excuse, well, in our neighborhood, we don't have to recognize international law, is simply a repudiation of international law.
I'm not saying that we do not have to recognize international law. There are conditions where you cannot apply these lofty principles, which are very important, but you cannot apply them. The British
is an interesting example.
They did it in Gibraltar, with Margaret Thatcher, the Falklands, anywhere.
It compared the British policies of torture in Northern Ireland with Israeli policies of torture. And in the 1970s, there were thousands of terrorist attacks by the IRA. And B'Tselem's comparison showed that the Israeli record is much worse than the British on the question of torture. That's the facts.
Yeah. you face now in this country a challenge of terrorism, so you go to Patriot Act and you go to the NSA listening
to people. You won't find me justifying torture.
These are the conditions that can be very dire,
no
very difficult.
Let me ask Dr. Ben-Ami, on the issue of the United States, as you look here, coming here for a few days, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, do you feel there are problems with the detention of the hundreds of men that are being held at Guantanamo without charge and what happened at Abu Ghraib?
Well, I cannot condone that. I mean, I think that obviously it is a violation of international norms. There's no doubt about it. But I don't follow the internal American debate. I don't know if this society is scandalized by what happens and what is the degree of civic opposition. And if you have here organizations like not only B'Tselem, even Shalom Achshav, which is a centrist, is not a left-wing organization that exposes the sins of your own government, I don't know. Maybe yes. I think we are a society in the middle of a very complicated conflict. As I do admit, in this conflict, many atrocities were committed by both sides, however. But I do recognize our own shortcomings, blunders, and sins. And the only solution to this situation, the only solution, is to try and reach a final settlement between us and the Palestinians. There is no other way. There is no other way to split the land into two states, two capitals, trying to find the best way to end this conflict because much of the instability of the Middle East has to do with our condition. You don't need to be a Bin Laden or a Saddam Hussein who tried to put on themselves the mantle of the vindicators of the Palestinian cause in order to say that the Palestinian issue is a platform of instability and in the region that needs to be solved. But even when it is solved, let us not fool ourselves. Many of the problems that the West is facing today with the Arab world will persist. The Palestinian issue has been used frequently by many Arab rulers as a pretext for not doing things that need to be done in their own societies. But for the sake of the Israelis, when I say that we need to make concessions, it is not because I'm concerned with the future of the Palestinians or because I'm concerned with international law. I want to say it very clearly. It is because I define myself as an ardent Zionist that thinks that the best for the Jews in Israel is that we abandon the territories and we dismantle settlements and we try to reach a reasonable settlement with our Palestinian partners. It's not because I'm concerned with the Palestinians. I want to be very clear about it. My interpretation, my approach is not moralistic. It's strictly political.
That was former Israeli Foreign Minister Shlomo Ben-Ami, author of Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, the Israeli-Arab Tragedy. He is the head of the Toledo Peace Center in Spain now. Also our guest for the hour, Professor Norma Finkelstein. He is the author of Beyond Chutzpah on the Misuse of Antisemitism and the Abuse of History, professor at DePaul University in Chicago. This has been an edited version of the debate they held in our Firehouse studio last week. For the full unedited debate, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Also there, you will read a transcript of the whole broadcast, and we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. You can also go there and share your comments on today's debate as well as every other program. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That does it for today's broadcast. A very happy Valentine's Day to all and a happy birthday to Mike Kimber here at Democracy Now! Well, we want to thank all of our producers, especially Aaron Mate, for today's broadcast. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper. Sharif Abdelkadous also for engineering today's broadcast. Again, our website is democracynow.org. And thanks to Uri Gallet and Angela Alston. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.